Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. This is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Hannah White about Held in Contempt, What's Wrong with the House of Commons. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Great to be here.
This is both an incredibly sort of important book, but it's also an incredibly well-timed book as we see a variety of, challenges or problems afflicting British politics quite generally. And actually, some of these problems, and we might end up talking about this. Some of these problems are not unique to Britain as well. But one of the things the book does is tease out this fascinating relationship really between politics, politicians, the building and the political system that we've got in Britain. And I guess the kind of the place to start is really with the moment. One of the things the book does in its introduction is talk about a kind of an exceptional context that is facing Parliament, but particularly the House of Commons. So I wonder if you could set the scene with what are we talking about in terms of that exceptional context?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's exactly as you say, Dave. It's some of the things I talk about in the book are not new and are trends which have persisted over a period of time. But the last sort of 5-7 years here in the UK have been a very exceptional time for British politics. In 2016, we had the Brexit referendum. We had the largely unexpected result that the country voted by a very narrow margin to leave the European Union. And that really threw politics up in the air to a great extent. It meant that there was this opposition almost set up within the British political system between the legitimacy of the referendum and the result that had been delivered to say, you know, people saying we want to leave the EU, and the rest of the political class and the representative democracy system and the parliament, who largely, you know, the majority of them had campaigned to remain in the EU. And then once they had this instruction from the British people to say, no, we're going to leave, there was this very difficult period where Parliament tried to have its say over how that process should happen. And the government largely resisted, and that caused some really interesting dynamics in the political system, not least because it was a period when there was either a minority government, so a government with no majority in the House of Commons, which is very unusual in the political system here, or a very small majority. So it was not easy for government to handle Parliament, but at the same time, it was trying to do a very difficult thing, deal with Brexit, deal with a lot of legislation that needed to be passed, and a deal that needed to be negotiated with the EU in the run-up to Brexit. So that was one factor which has made things very exceptional. The other, of course, is the COVID pandemic, which has been very much an international phenomenon, but has been, again, a period in which Parliament's role has been, to a large extent, sort of sidelined. That was something that politicians tried to achieve during the Brexit period. They wanted to get on and do Brexit without too much interference from Parliament. And then in the COVID period, we've had a government with a much bigger majority able to do what it's wanted to do, but having to do things very quickly, having to use lots of powers to pass legislation which Parliament hasn't had much of a say over. And that's been very tricky, again, with the public, and the public's perception of what's gone on in Parliament, because the public have been asked, as they have across the world, to do some really difficult things by politicians, and yet Parliament hasn't had very much of a say in that. So we've had this really tricky period, which we're only really just starting to come out of, I'd say.
I mean, the book goes on from that, as you describe, sort of tricky period, to really detail a range of faults that mean that the institutions are not working in the way that they should. But I should say, actually, before we, you know, kind of get into, I guess, the sort of what's wrong with the House of Commons parts of the book, it is worth flagging that in some ways this is a kind of a defence of the House of Commons and I guess a kind of a sense of what's possible or, you know, what good kind of legislative scrutiny, what a good institution, what perhaps good architecture for Parliament could be. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about kind of why the House of Commons matters, what its kind of role is in terms of holding governments to account, why, or, you know, maybe why it's important that the public trust it. And I guess the kind of the ideal that you're hoping could be achieved through various, you know, critiques that come later in the book.
Yeah, so I mean, you might not think it from the title of the book, but I am a massive supporter of representative democracy, and I think that Parliament is a really crucial part of our democratic system here in the UK. And so I think it plays a number of important roles. I mean, it has functional roles. Its job is to sign off the money that government wants to spend, to pass the laws that government wants to pass, but also crucially to hold government to account, to be the body which in our system, the ministers are drawn from within the elected ranks of MPs to become ministers and to become the government. The largest party becomes the government, but those ministers are held to account by their peers within the House of Commons. And I argue in the book, and this isn't a novel argument, but I think it's a really important sort of reminder that that's actually really important for stable, trusted government, for the public to trust this government, which is, as we've said in the pandemic, sometimes asking them to do some really dramatic things. They have to feel that the ministers aren't exercising their power in an arbitrary way, that there are people who can ask them questions, can dig down into why they're doing what they're doing, can ask questions after the event if things go wrong to try to prevent things going wrong again. These are all roles that Parliament plays, and it has this important symbolic role in the system that people can look at it and think, well, you know, there are people there who we've voted for who have the legitimacy to ask these questions on our behalf and make sure that the ministers are doing a good job. And I think if it becomes a very tokenistic relationship between government and Parliament, where government sort of largely tries to sort of do what it wants to do and not engage too much with Parliament, then that sense that this is a functioning, useful part of the accountability system ebbs away. And if the public look at the people who are in Parliament and don't respect them, because as you said, David, has a whole series of ethical sort of scandals over recent weeks and months and years here, then I think that is problematic, because they think, well, who are these people? Who do they think they are? And too often, the answer to that is these are people who think that the rules don't apply to them. So they're people who are asking everybody else to follow a set of rules. They're passing these laws, but they're not actually following those rules themselves. And then that creates a sense of sort of hypocrisy for the public, and a danger that they cease to respect the institution of Parliament and the role that it plays, and that undermines our whole system of government.
Maybe we'll take out the two points you've made there in turn. The first thing is, you know, you mentioned this kind of sense of accountability. And one of the things that's been quite a lively set of discussions over the course of the pandemic period, but as you mentioned, you know, it's got a slightly longer history, is this problem of Parliament not scrutinising the government, Parliament being kind of sidelined, both in terms of, you know, specific examples where, you know, literally we have sort of legal frameworks coming in with little or no parliamentary oversight at all, or I guess a more general drift, which again has been long debated around governments that have large majorities and how you might kind of, you know, scrutinize and rein them in. So I guess the question is, in this kind of particular post-pandemic moment, how has Parliament, how has the House of Commons been sidelined, and how has it sort of stopped doing its key job?
So I think that there are a number of problems. One is, you know, in the context of the pandemic, a lot of legislation had to be passed very quickly. So ministers got used to using the procedures in the House of Commons, which are designed to enable that, which is, you know, really important in the context of a pandemic. If you need to be able to do things and you need to be able to do things quickly, you do need to be able to pass legislation fast. What we've seen, though, since, as the pandemic has progressed and sort of we all hope is we're moving on from it, is the ministers have continued to tend to use those powers of accelerated passage of legislation, which means that Parliament doesn't get as many opportunities to go into the detail and to scrutinise the policies that governments are passing, even when there is no actual justification for speed. And we had a case of that. The government wanted to bring in a tax rise to pay for specifically for social care, and it decided to pass the legislation within a week of having announced that change. It passed the legislation within a week, which is exceptionally quick. And there was no apparent justification for doing that, other than if they left it too long, there might have been, I think, more political problems to handle around it. So that's one problem. Another problem is an increasing tendency for governments to try to pass what we call skeleton bills. And these are bills where the government doesn't include a lot of detail of policy on the face of the bill, of the piece of legislation. What they do is in the piece of legislation, they say, we are going to give ministers powers to fill in all this detail after the law has been passed. So it's just a power on the face of the bill. It's just an ability for ministers to pass what we call secondary legislation, which gets much less parliamentary scrutiny. It's really a very much take it or leave it process for Parliament. And so that was sort of necessary in the Brexit period because there was a lot of unknown and the laws had to be passed very quickly. In the COVID period, new powers did need to be taken, although lots of the powers that government used to do things like impose lockdown were already there in some pre-existing public health legislation. But we are increasingly seeing this as a wider trend, that rather than giving Parliament the opportunity to scrutinise policy on the face of the bill and to have detailed debates about it in committees and in plenary, instead, we just see Parliament being asked to hand over powers to ministers, and then there's much less control over what they then do with those powers. So that is another problem that we've seen. I think there's this sort of increased use of procedures, which essentially mean that Parliament doesn't get as much say over the policies that government's bringing forward, means that it's much weaker in terms of the scrutiny that it's able to do.
And there are big questions about the people doing that scrutiny. And one of the things, I think it's the second chapter in the book, one of the points it makes is that Parliament is not very representative of the population for a body of individuals in the House of Commons who is supposed to be, as you've mentioned, a representative democracy. So I guess it'd be useful to know, without sort of, you know, being too personal or naming too many names, what is the problem of kind of unrepresentativeness that we have in the House of Commons at the moment, particularly, you know, that lack of representation when it's applied to things like scrutinising bills or looking at secondary legislation?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, it's entirely possible for somebody to represent the views of someone else or the experience of someone else if they're not descriptively representative of that person. You don't have to be a woman to talk about the experiences of women and so on. But I do think that there are a number of problems with the fact that the House of Commons is not descriptively representative of the population. And that's in both in terms of gender, where after having had the possibility of women becoming MPs for over a century now, only a third of MPs actually are. It's also in terms of lots of other aspects of diversity, including ethnicity, age, disability, sexual orientation, and so on and so forth. I think it's a problem from a symbolic point of view that, as I've said, you know, people look at the House of Commons, they look at these people who are setting the laws for the rest of them, and they don't necessarily have confidence that these people who are there are bringing have the sort of life experience that they have, that should be represented in the House of Commons. And I think that's symbolically important for people looking at the House of Commons, but it's also practically important for the effectiveness of the House. And as you say, you know, this actually has a real impact on, you know, passage of legislation and so on, because it is actually, you know, there is academic research which proves that people who act as legislators are more likely to raise issues and to talk about things which they themselves have personal experience of. And we've seen it, for example, if you look at the gender angle in the House of Commons, that as more women joined the House of Commons as MPs, issues like childcare, like flexible working, which hadn't really been on the agenda at all for the House of Commons, suddenly started to be things which were discussed. And these are things which, you know, people are just more likely to raise if they have that experience of it themselves. So I think there's an effectiveness argument that if you want a legislature which is going to tackle the problems and deal with the experiences of the people who elect the people who are there, then it's important for it to look, obviously not identical, but as close as possible as you can to representing all the diversity of experience and characteristics that are there in the population more generally.
And you'd hope a more representative body of MPs would lead to a cultural change in the House. And later on in the book, you talk about a series, really. I mean, I describe it as a kind of almost institutional culture of things like bullying, sexual harassment, which have been, you know, both individual scandals, but I think as a result of the various bits of reporting and also attempts to kind of shift and change or hold to account particular MPs, we've seen this kind of sense of the House having a pretty grim institutional culture. And this goes right the way back to where you started. Actually, you know, you talked about there is this potential problem that MPs see themselves as being a bit kind of exceptional, a bit different, rules not applying to them. And I guess the recent scandals are a good illustration of this. So I wonder if you could sort of set out what has been going on really in the House of Commons over recent years and the, I suppose, the kind of challenge that brings when we're thinking about the Commons as an institution that can do good things and should be defended.
Yeah, so I think that the problems we've seen sort of come down to a couple of broad characteristics of the House of Commons as an institution. I mean, one is that it very much, any large institution is going to represent the sort of preferences and the experience and the expectations of the people that make it up. And over time, you know, as we've just discussed, the House of Commons has not been a very diverse place, and it has been set up in such a way that it reflects the experience and so on of essentially older white men who are comfortable with a certain way of operating the institution. And other influences have been relatively fewer and harder to sort of bring into that culture. The other sort of characteristic of the House of Commons, which sort of generates this sort of cultural dynamic, I think, is the fact that it's always had this important principle that the House of Commons governs itself. We call it exclusive cognizance, and it's the fact that only MPs and only the current set of MPs can determine how the House is and should be run. And that means that it's very difficult to have any sort of independent or external influences over those decisions. And what we've seen that lead to has been a series of scandals. We've had, if you go back as far as 2010, there was an expenses scandal where a large number of MPs were discovered to have in some way misused the expenses system which they had, which was additional to their salary, and a lot of them had sort of treated it as though it was just additional salary top-up and they had a right to claim it and had claimed some of the wrong things. And I think that part of the reason we got into that situation was because the House of Commons was was very focused that it should be in control of its own sort of financial system and determining salaries and expenses and so on. And that was all done in-house, and it made it a very inward process where actually things were done for the benefit of MPs rather than for the benefit of taxpayers. Then more recently, we've had the Me Too movement had a wave through Westminster, and we've seen a lot of scandals around bullying and harassment. And again, I think that can be traced back to a sense of MPs who are not employees, who are not employed by anyone except elected by the people, having this sense that actually the rules that apply to everyone else in terms of HR and, you know, not harassing your staff don't really apply to them. And there were no proper systems of investigation or sanction against MPs who might behave in that way, because there was this sort of assumption that, oh, well, you know, MPs are honourable members and they should only determine for themselves what was good or bad behaviour, and they shouldn't be held to external standards. And that created a really bad working environment for staff, also, I think, for other MPs. And that's one of the things I've been reflecting on in the last couple of weeks, when we've had a number of further scandals about misogyny and sexism in the House of Commons, has been that actually the work that's been done since the Me Too problems that there were has maybe been better for staff than it has for members themselves. And my observation in recent weeks is that female MPs still seem really worried about the prospect of calling out bad behaviour. The culture hasn't really changed for them. Maybe staff are now able, because a lot of sort of new systems and processes have been put in, the staff of the House of Commons and the House of Lords are better able to challenge bad behaviour from MPs. But I'm not sure that for MPs themselves that dynamic has changed as much as we might hope.
Yeah, and depressingly, for people who sort of follow daily news in Britain, there does seem to be either a reflection of that lack of change or a fresh set of scandals, certainly weekly, but in some cases daily, which doesn't really sort of bode well in terms of your hope for, I guess, kind of reform and change of the House of Commons. And on that point, this runs right the way through the book, actually, but the sort of concluding parts of the book look at the building itself. And it's sort of funny to spend, you know, a lot of time worrying about the state of a building. But as you mentioned right at the very end of the book, you know, the building itself is probably quite a severe fire risk, and there are numerous health and safety problems with it. There are certain things where it's just really not fit for purpose anymore, particularly actually in terms of things like MPs' office spaces and, you know, the ability to sort of have a pleasant physical working environment. And I guess that, you know, kind of story of the building is a physical kind of depiction of some of the other failures or some of the other problems of the House of Commons that you detail throughout the book. So I guess the kind of the question there is, what is wrong with the building? What is wrong with having, you know, a royal palace effectively that can't really be transformed or dealt with without huge expense and hugely complicated processes? And is it kind of fit for hosting a legislative body?
I mean, the short answer to that is no, absolutely not. I mean, in a kind of, again, in a sort of symbolic sense, the Palace of Westminster, which is a sort of iconic building which everyone would think of when they think of Westminster, with Big Ben and the sort of Gothic, neo-Gothic towers over the Thames, is falling apart. But the starting problem, really, before you even get to the sort of decrepit state of the building, and in fact the dangerous state of the building, as you say, there's a massive fire risk, but there are also risks from falling masonry and from very ancient mechanical and electrical systems and so on. This was a building which was built by the Victorians to embody a whole set of values around a parliament which just don't hold in the modern era. So it was built to be very sort of impressive. It was a sort of representation in many ways of the UK sort of imperial status. It's a very exclusive building. It's all about maintaining hierarchies and places where MPs and peers can go, but the public aren't welcome. The spaces where the public can go are relatively limited. There's lots of kind of rules and quite a lot of sort of open rules, but also unknown rules that you might, you feel as you walk around the building, you might inadvertently wander into the wrong place and then you would get sort of told off or arrested by the police. It's a very unwelcoming building designed to maintain the sort of prestige and superiority of a class of ruling politicians. And that is not at all how I think most parliamentarians would like to think of their parliament today. Today, it should be all about, inclusion and the public finding this to be an accessible place and somewhere where, the parliament, belongs to them as much as it does to politicians. But that is not what we have. And we have this building, which is a sort of heritage icon, but which is having to have hundreds of millions of pounds a year spent on it just to try to keep up with the scale of the things that are going wrong with it. But at the same time, politicians cannot agree on a larger scale programme of works which is needed, which would cost billions of pounds and practically involve Parliament moving out of Westminster for a period of years. No generation of politicians has been able to reconcile itself to the trade-offs and the disadvantages that would present for them personally, and to say, yes, this is a nettle we have to grasp. Instead, every generation has passed that problem on to their successors. I really fear that we're going to end up in a situation where not only are we spending millions of pounds and the legislature is meeting in a very suboptimal place, but also we're going to end up with somebody getting seriously hurt or killed because of the dangers of the building.
So what is to be done? Throughout the book, you have sort of, not just at the end of each chapter, but you keep coming back to ideas for reform, for change. And as I say, and as I've stressed, that kind of potential for the sort of high standards that Parliament and the House of Commons in particular could embody. So what are some of the recommendations, ideas, some of the sort of potential reforms that the book discusses? Because I think I mentioned at the start, this is not a book that says they're all absolutely useless. There's nothing that can be done. We need some kind of revolution to get rid of them. It is very much a book that's about, there are things that can be done to sort this out.
Yes, I think the most fundamental thing that needs to happen is that MPs themselves need to recognise that the low public trust in Parliament and in politicians is a problem, but it's also, and it's a serious problem, but it's a problem that they can and should try to address, rather than, as I sort of feel sort of frustratedly watching, that they too often say, oh, well, isn't this terrible? Nobody has trust in politicians, but they don't really try to do anything about it. I come up with a number of thoughts. One, the most important really is about the balance of power between the government and Parliament itself. And one of the big impediments to Parliament sort of improving and reforming itself is the high degree of control that the government has over Parliament as an institution, and the fact that if something isn't in the interests of government, might shift the power more towards the legislature or towards the public, then the government just doesn't have to provide time for a debate or a decision, and nothing can happen. And so that sense that government has a responsibility to think about the value and the credibility of Parliament as an institution, and that it's in its own interests to do so, because otherwise, as I said at the start, ultimately a weak Parliament undermines government as well. That's one of the sort of the key arguments that I make, that the government needs to recognise that. The government needs to think in a bigger picture way about the reputation of Parliament when it's making short-term political decisions. I think too often MPs are inclined to sort of respond to problems which occur in Parliament by saying, oh, you know, it's a few bad apples. Don't worry, you know, the system isn't the problem. It's just, you know, there's this one person who's done this thing wrong. And actually, I don't think there's often a serious enough look at what the systemic cultural issues are, as we've discussed, which might encourage people who are sort of inclined to behave badly to behave in that way. I think that MPs generally need to reflect on what I talk about as the sort of the limits of their specialness. I have a whole chapter, and you might think I have something a bugbear about this, but a whole chapter which is titled Exceptionalism, and it talks about why MPs think that they are special and what the good grounds are for that, but what also the limits are of the specialness of an MP. And I think that MPs need to recognise that and to behave accordingly. Then there's a whole set of recommendations around the representation point that, you know, it's really important for political parties to think about how to increase the diversity of the House of Commons in the candidates that they choose to become their MPs. But actually, MPs themselves also have a responsibility to think about how inclusive and welcoming a space the Parliament is, that it's somewhere that a diverse set of people might look at and think, yes, I can see myself there and I would like to go and be a part of that. And at the moment, and particularly in the last few weeks with the sort of misogyny scandal that we've had, I don't think the Parliament is doing a good job of that at all. So those are just some of the things which I highlight. And some of them, you know, are there's some very practical things around, you know, providing time for debates on specific changes to procedure or practice, which currently don't have to happen. But there's also some bigger ways in which I think MPs and the government need to reflect on the sort of value of Parliament and not just seeing it always either from the government's point of view, an impediment to something they might want to do, and from MPs' point of view, just a sort of given that people will always have respect for Parliament as an institution, because I don't think that that's something we can be entirely sanguine about.
The book is something that I think, and you've illustrated it really well there, that basically sort of everybody in Britain should be reading, really, to think about what's going wrong with its system of legislature and to an extent government, and, you know, what we might do about it. But on a personal level, obviously the book is, you know, kind of incredibly well-timed and speaks to these debates that we've got right now. But are you thinking about, I mean, hopefully not a sequel, you know, another book, you know, sort of hopefully saying, you know, what went right in terms of reform. You know, you do obviously lots of work for and with the Institute for Government, which, you know, has got a great reputation for shaping kind of, you know, better government in Britain and indeed elsewhere. Or do you think this, you know, was kind of it for books for you for a while?
Well, don't ask my family. But I mean, one of the things I actually would like to look at more, but this isn't going to be a quick fire thing, but one of the things which currently I think, you know, is missing from the current book and is something which I'd like to reflect on more and address is our voting system in the UK and the extent to which the way in which Parliament operates and our politics operates is driven by the first past the post system. And what the alternatives might be, because a lot of time when I was thinking about behaviour, culture, process, procedure, so many things to do with how Parliament works are fundamentally bound up with the first past the post electoral system. And I just think it would be a really interesting sort of intellectual and imaginative exercise to think about how things might work differently if you used a different system for choosing the MPs who are in Parliament. So that is something I'm sort of toying with, but as I say, don't let my family hear me say that.